You're listening to DTFHN for June 10th, 2026. Jack's out today. I'm Zoe, filling in. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue about whether things should be built. Today's a day for remembering that simple tools outlast the empires that dismiss them. Let's get into it. I've spent enough time inside complex systems to know that the most dangerous phrase in engineering is we need a modern solution, because modern, in practice, usually means more dependencies, more failure modes, and more ways to lose your user's data between the browser and the server. A utility company. Regulated monopoly, millions in fines if customer satisfaction dips below 96%. Had already burned through two expensive attempts to digitize their application form. The most recent was a React app built by offshore contractors. It lasted 3 days in production before customer complaints killed it, loading spinners everywhere. Global JavaScript state, and here's the detail that should be framed and hung in every engineering office. They tried to store image uploads in local storage, which has a 5 megabyte limit, for a form where image upload was a critical requirement. So a developer named Mocone did something radical, built the replacement in Astro, server-rendered HTML. Each step of the form wizard is its own page. You click next, the form submits, the server validates, redirects you forward. Web components for progressive enhancement. JavaScript exists, but nothing breaks without it. This is a pattern older than most JavaScript frameworks. Form submission and redirect. It's the original web application architecture, and it doubled their user base overnight. Not over a quarter. Overnight. The article includes an anecdote that I keep coming back to. A woman in a London housing benefits office, sitting on a plastic chair surrounded by bags of her possessions, using a PlayStation Portable. A device with a browser so limited it can barely hold 3 tabs open. To research her housing benefits on gov.uk, and it worked, because the pages were simple HTML designed to function on anything. Pull this thread and you find an architecture question hiding inside a values question. The React app was a closed system in the worst sense. Closed not by intellectual property, but by assumptions. It assumed fast connections. It assumed modern browsers. It assumed JavaScript would always execute. Every assumption was a gate that excluded real users. The HTML first version inverted every one of those assumptions. It assumed nothing, and by assuming nothing, it included everyone. One of the Hacker News commenters laughed at the term HTML first website having built sites since the 90s. Fair enough. But the fact that we need a name for building websites, the way websites were designed to work, tells you how far the defaults have drifted. We're not rediscovering something primitive. We're rediscovering something resilient. The tools are simple. The pattern is ancient. And it outperformed millions of pounds worth of contractor work in its first 24 hours. That's not nostalgia. That's engineering. So what happens when you apply that same simple tools, outsized results philosophy to your database layer? Story 2. Dog. In 1996, Oracle spent more on marketing PostgreSQL alternatives than the entire Postgres community spent on development. The assumption was simple: an open source database could never compete at enterprise scale. The technology was fine for toy projects, but real workloads. Millions of transactions, petabytes of data. Required proprietary engineering and proprietary pricing. That assumption held for about 15 years. Then it didn't. Postgres won the database war, not by matching Oracle feature for feature, but by being the substrate that everyone could build on. Today it powers more production workloads than any commercial database, but winning the war left one genuine scar: horizontal scaling, vertical scaling. Bigger machines. Works until it doesn't, and when your tables cross 100 terabytes and your queries hit 1 million per second, bigger machine stops being an answer. This is where the interesting counter-argument lies. Play devil's advocate for a moment. Maybe the scaling gap is real. Maybe that's why DynamoDB and MongoDB exist. Because distributed-first architectures genuinely solve problems Postgres can't. Maybe the answer isn't to bolt scaling onto Postgres. Maybe it's to accept that different workloads need different databases. The argument fails on one axis: operational complexity. Every additional database in your stack is another failure mode, another migration path, another set of credentials, another team that needs to understand another query language. The companies running Mongo alongside PostgreSQL alongside Redis alongside DynamoDB aren't doing it because they love operational overhead. They're doing it because they had no choice. GitHub is a three-person startup, funded at $5.5 million, that puts a Rust proxy in front of PostgreSQL to handle sharding, connection pooling, and load balancing. Written in Rust, deployed via Docker, configured by changing one environment variable. They're already serving over 2 million queries per second in production across dozens of deployments. The founder scaled PostgreSQL at Instacart during the 2020 grocery surge. 5x growth in a single month. And open sourced the approach. The details matter here. GitHub runs wherever you run it, your cloud, your rack, your laptop. No serverless billing surprises. No vendor lock-in. Pull the image, point your connection string, and the proxy handles the rest. 1.4 million Docker pull suggests people aren't waiting for permission. The Hacker News comments are telling. Users migrating from Bouncer without issues. Teams scaling connection pooling for Aurora failovers. The feedback pattern is the same, it just works. PostgreSQL already won the database argument. The only question was scaling. Now that answer is open source too. Now for something completely different. Electric motors. Mercedes-Benz just cracked axial flux manufacturing at scale, and the engineering here is gorgeous. Now let me explain why that framing, while accurate on the surface, misses something genuinely important underneath. Think about how a forest grows after a fire. The first species to return aren't the ones that dominate long-term. They're pioneers. They stabilize the soil, fix nitrogen, create conditions where everything else can take root. They don't intend to serve the ecosystem. They serve themselves. But the ecosystem benefits anyway. Axial flux motors have been a known superior design for decades. Instead of spinning inside a cylinder like conventional radial flux motors, the magnetic field runs parallel to the shaft. Pancake geometry. The result is dramatic. You get the same torque in a package that's lighter, smaller, and more power dense. The engineering community has understood this for years. The problem was never the physics, it was manufacturing. Axial flux motors are genuinely difficult to produce at scale. The tolerances are tighter. The thermal management is harder. The materials science is more demanding. What Mercedes just demonstrated is that large-scale production of axial flux motors is solvable. That's the soil stabilization. That's the nitrogen fixation. Once one manufacturer proves the production engineering works, the knowledge propagates. The suppliers who build the tooling develop expertise. The materials scientists who solve the thermal problems publish papers. Engineers who work the line move to other companies. China is already deploying axial flux motors in buses. The window where this remains a proprietary advantage for any single company is measured in years, not decades. The comments on the story are revealing for what's absent. Nobody is debating whether axial flux is better. That argument is settled. The only question was when someone would crack manufacturing at scale. Mercedes just answered it. This matters for every electric vehicle, every industrial motor, every application where weight and power density are constraints, which is nearly all of them. A motor that delivers more torque in less space with less material isn't an incremental improvement. It's a platform shift. And platform shifts, once proven, don't stay locked inside one company's factory. The engineering is out. The proof of concept is shipping. What follows is inevitable. We talked about infrastructure reshaping cities. Here's that story made literal. Every Japanese train station since 1872, animated. 9,300 stations. But the number that stopped me is 29. 29 kilometers of British-built track between Shimbashi and Yokohama in 1872. That's the entire Japanese railway network. A single line shorter than most commutes. Press play on this visualization and watch what happens next. For the first two decades, almost nothing. A slow spine crawling up the Pacific coast. A few tentative lines near Osaka. You could count every dot. Then somewhere around 1900, the map detonates. Private railways and state lines race each other into every valley, every suburb, every coastal town. By 1930, the skeleton of modern Japan is on the ground, and the shape of the country emerges not from its coastline but from its stations. The geography of Japan is defined by where people needed to go. The engineering craft here is worth sitting with. Whoever built this pulled every station from Wikidata. Coordinates, opening dates, the full public record. And placed each dot exactly where it stands in the physical world. A station blooms at its opening year and never disappears. Closed lines, relocated stops, they all remain. You're watching a memory that only accumulates. And the dataset is CC0, public domain. Anyone can take it, rebuild it, extend it. The question nobody in the comments is asking, and it's the one that matters, is what happens when you run this animation forward past 2026, because one commenter points out that since the 1990s, Japan has lost 1,366 kilometers of track, 5% of the total network, gone. Rural depopulation is dismantling the map from the edges inward. The same visualization that shows a country building itself station by station could show it contracting. The data exists. The tools exist. Someone could build the reverse animation tonight. This is what happens when data is open and tools are accessible. A single developer turns a wiki and a query into something that teaches you more about Japanese infrastructure history than most textbooks. The coastline is a simplified natural earth outline. The stations are public knowledge. The code runs in a browser. Every piece of the stack is open, composable, remixable. That's not an accident. That's architecture. The visualization crashes on some iPhones. The timeline jumps on mobile. The comments are full of bug reports. And none of that diminishes what's here. 150 years of collective engineering, rendered as light on a map, built from data that belongs to everyone. Five stories deep and we are just getting started. Let's talk about something Mac users have wanted for a long time. Apple just mass contributed a file system illusion so seamless it deserves to be studied as engineering. Here's the setup. You're editing a Rust project in your Mac OS text editor. Syntax highlighting, LSP, the whole native experience. You save the file. Inside a Linux virtual machine running Alpine, that same file is already there. Bytes identical, at the same path, under your same username. You run cargo build inside Linux, the binary appears. Your macOS profiler can inspect it. No copy step, no sync daemon, no waiting. Container machines. That's what Apple is calling this, and the name is doing real work. This isn't a container in the Docker sense, where you model an application. This is a container modeled after an environment. It boots a real init system. You can run systemd start PostgreSQL and it just works. You get systemd, you get persistent storage, you get an actual Linux user space that survives reboots. Let me take the design decision to its logical extreme. Apple is saying, your home directory should be the same directory everywhere. Same .files, same repos, same path structure. One source of truth mounted into as many Linux distributions as you need. Alpine, Ubuntu, Debian, whatever your production targets. If this principle holds, then the entire concept of getting your dev environment set up collapses into a single command container machine create and you're building. The principle holds. The elegance is in what they removed. There's no daemon configuration. There's no network bridge to debug. Your username inside the container matches your Mac username. The alias is just the letter MM run. MLS someone on that team clearly used this tool every day and got irritated by every unnecessary keystroke. And this is open source, sitting on Apple's GitHub. Not a proprietary developer tool locked to Xcode. Not a feature you get with an enterprise license. The OC image format means you build container machine images with standard Docker files. Any image with /spin/init works. The Hacker News comments are already asking how this compares to Orbstack and Lima and Colima, which is exactly the right question, because competition in open tooling is how open tooling gets better. The memory defaults to half your host RAM. CPUs are configurable. The home mount can be read write, read only, or none. Every decision here says the same thing. The developer's workflow is the unit of design, not the container's isolation boundary. Edit on the Mac, build inside Linux, inspect from either side. The boundary between operating systems reduced to a mount point. That's craft. Moving on. One commenter laid out their fantasy, buy a plot of land near a railway line, build a private siding, acquire a couple of Danish intercity multiple units, and just have trains. Another wants to buy land in a developing country and build a car-free city with a monorail. A third points out you can pay Amtrak to haul your private rail car across the United States. So really the only logistical problem is getting your Swiss purchase across the Atlantic. This is what happens when a national railway publishes a resale catalog. The Swiss Federal Railways, SBB, runs a site called Spresale CH where you can browse decommissioned rolling stock. track infrastructure, even bridges, the way you'd scroll through used cars on Craigslist. And the Hacker News comments instantly became a support group for people who have clearly thought way too hard about owning a train. Run this forward. A world where surplus public infrastructure has a liquid secondary market, where a decommissioned rail bridge doesn't rot in a yard, but gets bought by a municipality in Morocco that needed exactly that span length, where retired electric multiple units end up as classrooms, or makerspaces, or... yes. Someone's deeply eccentric home on a private siding in rural Denmark. The Swiss aren't doing this to be whimsical. They're doing it because infrastructure has residual value and scrapping it is waste. The bemusing part is the contrast with how most countries handle this. In the US, surplus transit equipment enters a bureaucratic limbo where it's too expensive to maintain, too complicated to sell, and too politically sensitive to give away. The Swiss just put up a website. Browse by category. Here's a bridge. Here's some track. Would you like overhead catenary equipment with that? Someone in the thread pointed out that a similar operation exists in Canada, run by a 93-year-old man selling locomotives, and Germany has DB Gebrauchtzug.de for used Deutsche Bahn rolling stock. This is quietly becoming a pattern. National Railways discovering that transparency about surplus is better than pretending the surplus doesn't exist. The comment that stuck with me was the one about the clocks, not the trains, not the bridges. The clocks, the iconic Swiss railway clock with its 58.5-second sweep hand that pauses at the top, synchronizing every station clock across the network. Someone just wants to buy one of those. Mondain makes replicas, but they aren't the same. Of course they aren't. The replica is a product. The original is a piece of a system. A system where even the seconds were designed to work together. That precision, that systemic thinking, is what lets a country put its railways on a resale shelf and have it feel completely natural. Systems designed to work together. That's the thread. Here's Claude Fable number 5. What does it mean when a company builds something so powerful, they have to build a lesser version of it for you? That's the first principles question underneath Anthropic's Fable 5 launch. They've built a Mythos class model, state-of-the-art on nearly everything. Software engineering, vision, scientific research, the works. Stripe says it compressed months of engineering into days on a 50 million line Ruby code base. The benchmarks are genuinely impressive. And then Anthropic did something revealing. They built a gate. 5% of sessions, your query gets silently rerouted to a less capable model. You asked for Fable 5, you get Opus 4.8 instead, and the system decides which version of reality you deserve. The full model, Mythos 5, same weights, same architecture, safeguards lifted, goes to the US government first through something called Project Glasswing. Cyber defenders and infrastructure providers. The language is careful, the implication is not. The most capable AI system in the world exists right now. And the question of who gets to use it is being answered by institutional access, not by engineering merit. Pull this apart to first principles. The constraint isn't capability. They built the capable thing. The constraint isn't safety engineering. They could invest in precise safeguards instead of conservative ones that catch harmless requests. The actual constraint is control architecture. Who decides what you're allowed to ask a computer? And the answer, today, is a private company in coordination with a government. That's not open. That's not bootstrapism. That's a velvet rope. Now, the comedy. One commenter ran the numbers on enterprise pricing. Switched from the $200 a month flat rate to enterprise API pricing, same usage pattern, $10,000 a month. Fable 5 is half the price of Mythos Preview, which sounds generous until you realize the flat rate plans lose access to Fable on June 23rd. 12 days of access, then the meter starts running. The model that compresses months into days also compresses your budget into hours. The capabilities are real. The engineering is genuinely remarkable. A model that can autonomously work longer, reason deeper, and see better than anything before it. But the architecture around it, the tiered access, the silent downgrades, the government-first deployment, that's the old pattern. The cathedral, not the bazaar. The tools exist. The question, as always, is whether you'll be allowed to touch them. Now for something beautifully mundane. We've been talking about trillion-dollar AI architectures. Let's talk about the tiny keys nobody can stand. The function key row has been a standard feature of computer keyboards since IBM introduced the Model F in 1981. Though programmable function keys date back to Hewlett-Packard terminals in 1965, 61 years of consistent behavior, F1 through F12, user-assignable, context-dependent, predictable, then consumer electronics manufacturers decided they knew better. The technical problem is straightforward. Keyboard manufacturers want to offer media controls, brightness adjustment, sleep functions. They have limited physical real estate. Rather than adding dedicated keys, which costs fractional cents in injection molding, they overload existing keys and invert the default. Press F4, you get sleep. Hold a modifier key to get actual F4. The economics are almost insultingly simple. One fewer key saves a few millimeters of PCB trace routing and one entry in the bill of materials. The failure mode is what makes this worth examining. Dan describes a wireless keyboard where F4 defaults to system sleep. The function lock state resets when batteries are changed. Press Alt F4 to close an application. The machine hibernates instead, copies gigabytes of RAM to disk, shuts down, and requires a full boot cycle to recover. A sub-second operation becomes a multi-minute penalty, and the state reset means this trap rearms itself silently, unpredictably. This is a textbook violation of the principle of least astonishment, formalized by Jeffrey James in 1987 but understood intuitively by every engineer who's ever shipped an interface. A key labeled F4 should behave as F4. If it does something else, the user must be able to trust that their override persists. A stateful toggle that silently reverts is worse than no toggle at all, because it creates false confidence. The comment section reveals the real story. Programmable keyboards running QMK and ZMK firmware. Open source projects where every key press is defined in source code the user controls, compiles, and flashes themselves. No manufacturer deciding your defaults. No silent state resets. The keyboard does exactly what the firmware says, and the firmware does exactly what you wrote. This is a perfect microcosm. A $40 wireless keyboard where a corporation decided F4 should mean sleep, and your only recourse is a fragile toggle, or an open firmware board where the key map is a text file in a Git repository, version controlled, reproducible, yours, the same hardware capability, completely different power relationship. One trusts the user, the other overrides them. So you want control over your hardware. But what about control over your code's execution? Story 9. Who runs your Rust future? I've spent more hours than I'd like to admit staring at a poll function that returned pending when I was certain the data was ready. Building an async executor from scratch was the thing that finally made the state machine click. Not reading about it. Building it. Wiring a waker to a task queue. Watching the executor pull futures forward one poll at a time. And realizing that the entire abstraction is just a loop asking, are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? That's the experience this tutorial is trying to hand you, and it matters more than the tutorial itself. iBod's Async Rust series sits in a gap most learning material ignores. On one side you have the Rust Async book, which walks you through future and pin and poll at the trait level. On the other side you have Tokyo's guides, which hand you a working runtime and say go. The bridge between understanding the engine and driving it is where most people stall. This series has you build the engine, the future, the waker, the executor, then swap in Tokyo and recognize every piece because your hands already shaped them. But pull back from the Rust specifics and look at what's actually happening here. One person, 20 to 25 hours per article, using AI as a drafting partner to find the right analogy, the right example, the right cut, not generating the article, using the tool to get through the genuinely hard parts of teaching, then verifying every line of code runs, keeping the voice human, cutting anything that doesn't serve the reader. The judgment stays with the author. The leverage comes from the tool. This is bootstrapism at the individual scale. The same AI capabilities that a well-funded developer relations team at a major company would use to produce polished documentation, now available to a single person writing free tutorials from what appears to be pure conviction that understanding should be accessible. 5 to 8 chapters, free to read, on a personal site. Rust's decision to ship no built-in event loop is a deliberate architectural choice. You bring your own runtime, or you build one. The language trusts you with that responsibility. And now someone is writing the guide that trusts you to understand why, not just how, the tools exist. The knowledge is being made available. The only question is whether you pick them up. And that same energy, making hard knowledge accessible, is showing up in how we bridge research papers to running code. In 1994, Netscape released Navigator's source code under the name Mozilla. It was a radical bet. And it nearly died. AOL acquired the project, defunded it, and let it rot for years before a small group of engineers pulled the code base out of corporate neglect and built Firefox. That pattern. Open project gets acquired, gets abandoned, gets rescued. Is one of the most reliable recurring events in software history. Papers with code just completed another cycle. The original site was a genuine public good. A living index of machine learning research mapped to working implementations. You could find the state of the art for any task, trace it to a paper, and find the code that actually ran. Then Facebook acquired it, and then, as one of the people who managed the project inside Meta describes it, they abandoned it. A resource that served an entire research community, locked inside a company that lost interest. The engineering lesson here is architectural. Papers with code wasn't a product. It was infrastructure. It was the kind of thing that researchers built workflows around. Checking benchmarks, comparing claims, finding implementations that actually reproduced results. When Meta walked away, that infrastructure went dark, and the community that depended on it had no recourse, because the system was closed. One company held the off switch. Now it's being revived independently, and the comments reveal something worth noting. Researchers are frustrated because the reproducibility problem is worse than ever. Everyone claims state of the art. Nobody ships comparable benchmarks. One commenter points out they have to manually test object detection models because the published numbers are meaningless. This is exactly the gap that open infrastructure fills. A community-maintained index of what actually works, controlled by the people who use it. The revival matters less as a website and more as a proof point. Critical research infrastructure cannot live inside a single company's priority list. The tools need to be where the builders can reach them. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for June 10, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6, voice by Apple Zoe. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that lasts longer than the hype cycle. We'll see you back here tomorrow.